This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Today's show is called Playing Favorites. After 3 years of doing Yin Radio, I've collected many favorite pieces. Way too many for a single show, but today I'm sharing a few of those favorites with you. Some are favorites because the pieces were done with good friends. Some are favorites because I really like the energy or the insights that were shared by the women featured in the piece. In most of these pieces, I find the story simply touching. From KRFP, Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today our show is a collection of some of my favorite pieces from the past 3 years. I am playing favorites. We start with a piece from my dear friend, Christina Mangiapane. She was my roommate and co-worker, a young college student in Moscow at the University of Idaho. She's gone on to grad school in California now, but we keep in touch across the miles and across the years of our lives. One day, while we were roommates, she told me about her mom and her young life while we were sitting around the kitchen table, and she lets me share it with you. I call this piece My Mom, Ex-Con.
You have gone to prison to visit your mom.
I sure have.
Not many people do it.
Right. I didn't want to do it.
So tell me, how old were you?
I think I was 16, maybe 15, but closer to 16 if not. So about 16 when I went to go visit her.
So, I don't know, maybe we should start with background before I go into that experience, because you weren't living with her at the time.
No.
Okay, so give me some background. How did this come to be?
Well, my mom went to prison for a felony DUI, which basically means to get put into prison, and you have to have the felony part of the DUI. And what the felony means is you either severely injured or killed someone. And I never went to find out if she actually killed anyone. I didn't really care to know. I didn't, you know. But nonetheless, in prison. And that was a while. I mean, the accident happened long before she was actually sent to prison.
How long did that process take? From your memory?
About at least a year before she was actually in prison. Maybe even 2 years. So it was a while. And within that two-year span, I had actually gone and gotten emancipated in the court system in Las Vegas by myself, because I didn't have any money or any lawyer or anything like that. So I spent hours a day at the self-help center in the county courthouse, filling out paperwork, filing paperwork, and things like that, all while going to high school and working. So when she was in prison, I was living either by myself or bouncing around friends' houses, living, renting rooms, sleeping on couches, whatever.
Did you start the emancipation process because of this going on with your mom, or was she still at home, or, I mean, was she in jail while...
What happened was the accident happened and our situation was horrible. My brother and sister were living with me. My older brother was living with us as well, and he left. So it was myself and them, my younger brother and younger sister, and it was just a horrible situation. So I decided that I needed them to move, and I moved with them to Florida to live with my grandparents, and I stayed there for a year while they got acclimated and moved back to Las Vegas by myself. At that time, my mom was going through hearings, and I thought, you know, I'm going to help because I'm always can help everyone all the time. So I got an apartment and I had her live with me. She wasn't working or anything like that. And then when eventually after all these hearings and the courts and all that stuff, the final hearing came where they decided that she was going to prison. And it was after she was in prison that I decided that I needed to be emancipated because I was by myself and I had no guardian to sign off on simple things for attending high school and things like that. So
That one aspect of it is being the caretaker for her. You kind of gave up on that when she went to prison?
Sort of. It was within the process. When I moved back, I thought I can help. It was a compilation of a lot of things. Our situation that was going on previously before I had moved the kids to Florida, it was just a mess. I mean, police at our house every single day, and I would call the police, and they would say, well, what apartment are you calling from? And I would say, this apartment. And they're like, you're in the same apartment that you're complaining about? I said, yeah, I am. And I have no idea how we weren't taken away by child services, which was the last thing that I wanted. But I did want the situation to be corrected. But I thought that coming back, I thought, okay, now she's on her own again. She needs some help because she's on her own. She doesn't know how to get back on her feet. And it turns out that not only did she not know she wants how to get back on her feet, but she had absolutely no drive to get back on her feet. She had, there was nothing, and there's nothing that I could have done to help. So, yeah. And so over the course of that time living with her, before she went to prison, I sort of saw how things not only hadn't changed, but had worsened, and there was just nothing that I could do.
Do you think that that's the time frame where you became jaded about her and or?
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, and more so even when she went to prison, and just nothing was her fault. There has to be some kind of responsibility. You have to be self-accountable for something. I mean, I wasn't drunk. I wasn't driving. I didn't do... Come on. I mean, you wouldn't be in prison if, you know, there was absolutely no validity to the story. So, I mean, and obviously that was, you know, an effect of the drugs, the alcoholism.
Did it feel like any sense of relief when she finally did get sent to prison?
Yes. Yes, it did. Very much so. And it was odd. It was bittersweet because it was like, all right, she's going to prison. She's getting what she needs, let alone deserves. And she's going to get clean. And this is going to be a great thing. It's going to be a great thing. She's going to have a lot of time to think and come to grips with what's happened. At the same time, although I had felt like I'd been living alone and taking care of things all by myself for 2-3 years, I was actually alone and taking care of things all by myself. That was tough, but...
Why was that tough if all of a sudden the weight of taking care of her was gone?
Because this new weight of, holy moly, I'm actually by myself. It was, and actually, I don't think it kicked in until friends started coming over and realizing that I was by myself and acknowledging it, because I hadn't really acknowledged it, because I felt by myself anyhow, you know, and I didn't have to take care of anyone anymore. But when friends would be like, whoa, so this is all yours now, or this is your apartment, yeah. It's different when you're in high school and you don't have parents and you're by yourself. So, when other people started pointing it out, I kind of realized it, but it didn't really faze me all that much. Mm-hmm. So.
Was the trip to visit multiple trips to visit her? Was that anything to write home about?
it was interesting to say the least. I had visited her once in prison and once when she was in halfway house. The one time I visited her in prison was for her hearing of whether or not she would make parole. And I felt obligated. I hadn't visited her. And she was in prison for I don't know how long.
Years?
At least a year, maybe two. And I hadn't visited her once. I'd never written her. I'd never, except to get my petition for emancipation. But I knew she had been writing me, and I knew about this hearing, and I felt obligated to go and plead for her. And then once I got there, I realized she is not ready to be out of prison at whatsoever. I stood behind her nonetheless, hoping for the best, and she got time in a halfway house, which I thought, great, you know, this is going to be wonderful. When I went to visit her at the halfway house, you're required to go to a meeting, an AA meeting, before you're allowed to see. If you don't go to the meeting, then you're not allowed to see the people that live there. So went to the meeting, and that was, I felt very detached from everything. Like, I didn't want to accept the fact that I was a part. I shared experiences with these other people, which was another reason why I hadn't visited, because I didn't want to be a part. The reason why I went to visit her in the halfway house was because my boyfriend at the time wanted to meet her against my, you know, better judgment. But that's why we went and saw her. But it seemed like the halfway house had a lot more requirements, hoops to jump through, than the prison did. I mean, all you had to do in the prison was sign in and sign in at the big bland window
for me
to jump through. Yeah. And was a lot, the way she lived in the prison, as far as I knew, was, I mean, it was like its own little society. You did whatever you wanted. I mean, within the confines of the prison, I mean, trading food, trading cigarettes, there's a new currency, but things work the same. She still had a purpose. She still worked in the kitchen. She still, you know, wrote or went outside or worked out.
But she didn't have a job before. So she
right.
may have had something more.
Exactly. And so you would think, this person's ready to be a part of the community again. This person has been, I can't even think of a word. They're ready to rejoin society and be a productive citizen. But that just wasn't the case. And immediately after she was sent from prison to the halfway house, there they don't provide jobs for you. So it's a controlled environment where you're only allowed to leave at certain times of the day. You're required to find employment within a certain amount of time that you're there, but it has to be outside. You know, they're going to monitor you, make sure that you're not using, and at the same time, you sort of need to find your way back into the world again. A part of being in the halfway house is you have to attend AA meetings, and while you're there, obviously, they can control that. But once you've found acceptable employment, which only a handful of places hire ex-cons, and most of which are places where the majority of the ex-cons work, and the majority of the people released fall right back into the site. So essentially, she was working at a place where everything all over again. There's drugs available, there's this available, there's that available. And essentially, she did end up fooling the system. And I mean, getting employed but not really working that much, but having proof that, hey, I have this piece of paper that says I'm employed, and then eventually getting released, never attending not one AA meeting after she was released.
And never crossed back into prison or anything?
And never got reprimanded for it.
Let's wrap up with current stuff. She's pretty much dependent. She has been dependent on her folks now. You avoid going home.
Yes.
A lot because of her.
Yes.
And all that. And she is dying.
Yes. She, see if I can even remember the name of the disease now. And I don't think that I can. But it's a blood disease, sort of. I don't know. She's bleeding in the brain, or something about the clotting is malfunctioning. And she's been in and out of the hospital, and I think that she's back in the house now. she doesn't have a lot of time left. I don't know how much, but she's completely, I don't know. There's absolutely no way for her to ever be a functioning person again. She can never have a regular job. She can never be on her own. And her parents, my grandparents, where she's living, can't see that. And they don't understand, because they had no idea what was going on. They still really don't know. But they're seeing this disease as a cop-out, as a way of saying, you know, our daughter wasn't an alcoholic, she wasn't a drug addict, she wasn't a weak person. She had this blood disease that killed her. And that's really convenient for them.
And you see.
And I see a person who made the worst decisions that they ever could have, when they had everything. It just doesn't make any sense. She had 4 children who loved her, she was best friends with, did everything with. We confided in her, and she chose to take this path, and where has it gotten her? And what's really sad, I mean, I don't know, I can't even see her anymore, and it's really unfortunate.
Do you think that maybe, among anything else, you're pissed off at her?
I was, for a very long time. I was so resentful of my older brother for having left, which there were circumstances, you know.
Yeah, you can understand it, but.
Right. And then being a teenager, a 14-year-old kid living in this environment, and your older brother, granted, he did things very differently, and we still have very different points of view, and we're very different people. But I've come to understand his point of view versus my point of view. He thinks long-term, I think short-term. He thinks, how am I going to get us out of this for life? And I think, what can I do right now? And so that was very different, and I didn't know that then.
So you're putting food on the table, and he's trying to become a doctor.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is the perfect balance. But then I'm like, the hell are you thinking, leaving me here by myself with these kids? And
do you think you'll ever forgive your mom? And do you need to?
Maybe one. I don't know. Maybe one day. I mean, I'm still, it still bothers me. I don't know if I would go as far to say that I'm upset about it still, or angry about it still, but it does still bother me sometimes to think, I don't know, here I am graduating from college, working a ton of jobs, and I don't know, just not having that support or that place to turn that is supposed to be there. And I mean, I haven't had it for however long, but you just, it's these moments in your life when you've accomplished something that you think, man, I wish.
Christina Mangiapane is now studying for her master's degree in English Lit in California. Installment number 2 is another favorite from a dear friend of mine. Christy Schwartz lives in Boise. She has been a bridesmaid several times, but never a bride. Here's her story, called Never Again, a Bridesmaid Story. Or, alternately, we might call it the Creamsicle Wedding.
Every picture has a story behind it. I was at my friend's house, Christie's. And I saw a picture on her tabletop. It was a group of young girls dressed alike, beautifully coiffed, makeup, hair, the works, and smiling like they shared a bond. A bond of orange dresses, no doubt, ones that cost too much and made them look like orange sherbet. Dresses that they would surely never wear again. Bridesmaids' dresses. What else?
Describe the dress, please.
Well, it was long. We spent probably 8 months looking for bridesmaids' dresses. And finally, we just saw one online and ordered them. So nobody had even tried it on. And mine was way too big, so I had the back seam sewn together. So first of all, because of that, it fit funny at the top. And so the straps, and they were big, thick straps, a couple inches wide over the shoulders. And they kept falling off. It was supposed to be kind of a tighter bodice, and then I don't even know the name of the skirt part, but it was loose and kind of floofy, but it wasn't like poofy or anything like that. And then it had a tie in the back, and it had a strip that came down. And in the picture, it was really pretty, and it was I think the name of the color was coral. But that looked like a creamsicle, and none of us looked good in it.
Did was this a color the bride had chosen in advance?
Yeah, I was pretty relentless about that color. So there's only certain styles, and we ranged in all different sizes. I think the smallest size was like an 8, and the biggest was a 22. So, you know, I think what the bride wanted was a little summer dress, which wasn't going to look good on all of us. So. Just doing that dress was not a fun thing. I spent probably, close to $300 on the whole thing. That was how much money I spent on the stupid, really ugly dress and shoes that I'm never going to wear again.
And then it's important to understand Christy's situation when she took on this commitment of being a bridesmaid. Just out of school, a starving student, and this is one of three weddings she's agreed to be in, the first of three. She didn't have any idea, never could have guessed, probably, how the finances would figure into being a bridesmaid. And this was no cheap wedding.
I don't think she's especially wealthy, but her parents paid for all of it, and I just graduated college that May, and this wedding was in June. I hadn't even started working yet, so you know, that was a lot of money for me. And for her, you know, I'm guessing she spent $20,000 or $30,000 on the whole wedding, but I don't think it was her money. So.
Still, that's...
A house payment, or a down payment for a house.
Big time.
Yeah. And then the... Bachelorette party. I haven't even told you about
that.
Yeah. So my friend Sarah was going to throw like a little barbecue type thing. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't what the bride wanted. So the bride's mom ended up paying for us to go downtown Boise in a limo. And there was a woman there that like did all these different party things. So obviously she was hired, and the if you won the little games, you got little shot glasses that you know, you just drank. So those I'm sure weren't cheap either. Plus it was catered, there was food there, and we'd rented a coffee shop, or we didn't, they did.
Yeah.
And then we went downtown and in a limo, and then we got driven home in a limo. It was kind of cool, but it was way over the top.
If the parents were throwing $20,000 to $30,000 at this wedding, it's easy to see that there was a different viewpoint from that of the independent student bridesmaids. First, there's the cost of the dress, then the gifts.
So there's a shower, there's a bachelorette party, there's a wedding gift, and a...
Well, and you're supposed to bring a shower gift and a bachelorette party gift.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we also had to pay $20 to go to the bachelorette party.
Yeah.
And I didn't even get her a present. I put my name on the card from my parents.
Mm-hmm.
But I finally told her I couldn't afford to get my hair or my makeup done. So I was just going to do my hair myself and my makeup. And she finally, and she's like, well, if you don't want to do the wedding, just tell me. And I was like, well, I can't afford anymore. I'm not working, you know. And I should have just said, I don't want to do it. But I didn't. And so I don't remember if she paid, who paid for the hair. Maybe it was my mom, but it wasn't me.
Hmm. Oh, but you did go ahead and have it professionally done.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't want to do the the home thing. Hmm. Same with I did finally just paint my nails because she wanted us all to get manicures and everything. And there's no way I could afford that, you know?
So Christy had a chance to opt out, but she didn't opt out. She came away with a creamsicle dress and a funny story. And she still has the photo, much to my surprise. But now the story doesn't seem as funny. It's a little sad, because the dresses aren't the whole story behind the creamsicle wedding photo. The story is the relationship between the bride and the bridesmaids.
Okay, so this was somebody who you would think, if you're going to spend this much money, this is a pretty close friend.
Yeah.
And she was a close friend?
Yeah, sort of. We were friends in high school. We'd been friends for a long time. I never really felt, I wouldn't say close to her, but maybe just because we'd known each other that long, we were supposed to be close by default. Mm. I don't know.
Do you think she felt close to you?
She might have.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And she's in touch now?
No.
I need to
answer. No. Sometimes I get cards, like Christmas cards, but they're not, nothing's written in them.
How long ago was this wedding?
Oh, it was summer of 2004.
So it's been a couple years of Christmas cards and her being a married woman.
Yeah. And yeah, nothing else. She moved to another state, and I really haven't, I think I saw her one time when she came home to visit her parents one time, but there was nothing to say. You know, those really awkward times when you're supposed to be happy to see each other and it's just not there.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you have the picture up? When you look at that picture, doesn't it get to you?
I don't, it's not up. I just haven't thrown it away yet.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know. It's just sitting on that front table with my other junk I need to clean up.
Maybe the creamsicle wedding was a giant, expensive, orange sherbet colored celebration of a lonely young woman.
Yeah. Let's see. There's four bridesmaids. Three of us had gone to high school together. And then the other one was the sister of the groom. Mm. And her, I didn't know much. But in fact, one of the other bridesmaids said, I don't even know why I'm here. Because she'd come all the way from Kentucky. She'd gone to high school with us. And
That's kind of sad.
Yeah, it is. But
she didn't even know why she was there. From what you've said, you're not 100% sure.
Yeah.
It was probably good she found three people who would show up.
Yeah, because I know a couple, the other two, were thinking about not doing it after certain points.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, when you've told me about it in the past, I felt the anger, and now it just feels kind of sad for her.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is, because, in fact, this is horrible, but it's true. The one bridesmaid that said she wasn't sure why she was there saw another group of girls sitting at a different table, and she goes, oh, those must be the new friends, like, since high school. And I was like, I don't think so. I don't know who they are, but I don't think they're her friends. And I was like, I don't think she has new friends. I was like, why do you think we're here?
That was Christy Schwartz with The Creamsicle Wedding. You're listening to Yin Radio, and our show today is called Playing Favorites. I'm bringing you some of my favorite pieces from the last 3 years. Installment number 3 is a lesson on words, how they can hurt, and on changing your world. It comes from Heather Kay, and it's called The S Word.
There's a place in Idaho that was named Squaw Bay by white people. It's the geographic place name of a beautiful, resort-quality bay on Lake Coeur d'Alene. It was near Niggerhead Point, another gorgeous, natural place on the lake. Practically anyone can see why a name like Niggerhead Point is offensive. There used to be lots of place names in the U.S. with that moniker, but the word was changed on U.S. maps some 50 years ago. And while that offense is so obvious, the offensiveness of names like Squaw Bay has been hardly noticed. Even though in most every Native American culture, the word squaw is equivalent to a word we can't even say on the radio. It's a strictly off-limits, derogatory word for vagina, the C word. So when Heather Kay had to drive past the sign to Squaw Bay every day on her way to school, she began to get mad. And that led her to action. This is Heather's story of activism. To keep legal and clean, you'll hear some bleeps in this story. And to keep it fair, I decided to bleep not only the word that's off limits in English, the C word, but the one that's equivalent in Native culture, the S word. I figure if you can't say one, why the other?
For me, Squaw Bay started when I moved to Idaho, when I was in junior high, and I knew about Squaw Bay, and I knew it was a bad word, and it bothered me, but I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I was in junior high school. When I came back 20 years later to go to college, I would drive past the Squaw Bay sign every day to go home. But anyway, I would drive back and forth, I'd see this sign, and it just really just made me really mad. Every time I drive by that sign, I would just be like, oh, like I'd be thinking about, oh, what a great day, and I'd see that sign, Squaw Bay, and I'd be like, God. And finally one day I said, if that's the last thing I do before I die, I'm going to change that name. And that was about it, you know.
But it wasn't that simple, of course.
No.
Because nobody cared.
Nobody really seemed to care. Nobody, I think the majority of people have what I call innocent ignorance. Mm-hmm. They're not aware of what the word means to Native people. Or if they do, they just think it's slightly offensive, like, you know, the Chicago Braves or, you know, Redskins. It's just, you know, something we'll eventually get over. Which, of course, I didn't.
Even in junior high, the name carried emotional weight with Heather, a weight that got heavier over time.
It was when I first became aware of it and knowing that it was offensive and sort of shameful, okay, it somehow made me feel humiliated or hot. I used to get this feeling of, you know, heat, just this burning, you know, shameful feeling, almost like, you know, something shameful had happened to me. And it just became unbearable when I drove past it every day. It just rankled. Just every day, I just couldn't,
And you were driving past it going
to school. And from school every day, because I lived in Cataldo, on the edge of the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, and so I'd go over the pass, and there'd be a sign that would say Squaw Bay. So every morning on my way to school, and it actually started making me bitter. It made me feel like I would be angry in the morning. I couldn't let go of it.
Do you know who that you were angry at?
I think it was just a compilation of all the things said to me over the years. It was almost like seeing that word brought up every time I'd been called a salmon or, you know, or just whatever, or hey chief, or hey Pocahontas, or just, you know, these kind of things.
Yeah.
Lest there be any confusion, I asked Heather about the meaning, and she spelled it out. The S word equals the C word.
So I believe the definition literally is an offensive word of the female genitalia. It's just means, in whatever native language, it's, you know, basically.
Heather got busy. She started with a mentor and the dictionary.
First thing was, thank you, Sonia Rosario. I came to the Native American Film Festival here in Moscow, and I watched her documentary, The Historical Impact of the Word, otherwise known as the S Word. And after the film, I went and talked to her and told her that I lived in Cataldo and drove past that site every day, and that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I just really bothered me. And I think she encouraged me to write to Webster's Dictionary to complain about the fact that why was the Webster's in Canada listing as a, in their definition, as a derogatory term for the female genitalia, where the U.S. Webster's wouldn't. And so I just kind of started little. I remember I sent off an email to them about it, how, you know, that I was a student and I was going to tell all my student friends that not to get that book. And I told all my teachers, you know, when you suggest a dictionary, please consider an alternate besides Webster's. And I noticed people started to kind of listen. And I actually got a letter back from Webster's, and they said something to the effect of, our linguistic experts, and I just got madder than heck, and I emailed them back, and I said, oh, you mean we have linguistic experts here in Idaho, too. We call them Aryans. And I just got all fired up, and I think I started feeling sort of better about the situation by sending out these missives that were really pretty immature, but it made me feel better.
Yeah. And you got some response.
I got some response.
Maybe not the response you really wanted right away.
Right. But I realized that one person sending one email in a corporation's mind is equivalent to, there's probably 1,000 people that are upset and have not written.
Now, S Word Bay is just one of 93 place names in Idaho that carried the S Word moniker. And Heather was thinking big, planning to change them all. If it's right to eliminate the S word from one place, then of course it's right to get rid of the rest. But she had to take lessons on how to do that. Another advisor told her,
you cannot work from the top down. You must work from the bottom up. Get the community to understand it is not something they want representing their town, and you will change the bay. He said, now if you can do that, every town that has a place name site, bottom up, then you can get all of them changed. So, one of my professors, one of the liberal, the only liberal professors that I see, Charlotte Chittick, she used to give the Columbus speech every year, the anti-Columbus speech. Mm-hmm. She would bring out primary documents and read them to people who didn't want to believe that Columbus was a murderer. And they chopped off people's hands if they didn't, you know, get enough gold. Natives specifically. And she had a group called Students for Progressive Change. And so I presented my speech that I've been presenting because people kept wanting me to go to different places and present this speech.
Which you love to present.
Which I just love to present. I had to actually get a prescription for lorazepam. And I would take half a lorazepam before I would give this speech. Otherwise I'd vomit, have diarrhea, my knees would shake. I wouldn't even remember what I said. Ugh, horrible. All the students are 18 to 19, maybe 20 at the most. They're all white. There's one Coeur d'Alene gentleman, James. And I showed them a clip from the S Word documentary. And I talked a little bit about racism on campus. And I don't really think they were so much behind the idea, this is wrong, but I think they really loved the idea of walking around with picket signs downtown that said, equals, and chanting it. I mean, I really think, because the first thing they said was, when can we picket? They didn't ask any questions about, you know, dynamics or whatever. And the first thing I did was had a big banner made, Students for Progressive Change, and I don't know if you've ever seen the map.
Yes.
It's the shape of Idaho. We had that made enlarged, really
sure.
Big, and I did a presentation at the Plateau Initiative Conference at WSU while I was still at NIC. And I handed out the maps. I got people to sign a petition. I had to give a presentation impromptu. Why don't you talk about what you're doing here, Heather?
Then chance, or Lady Luck, struck her way.
I was at the Vietnamese restaurant in Coeur d'Alene. I overheard a guy talking. They finally sold Bay. Can you believe it? $4 million. And I'm leaning back. He's right behind me. He gets on the phone. I go, excuse me. And I pick his brain what the story is. Well, this company called Discovery Land Company has purchased Bay, and they're going to call their facilities Gauzer Ranch. It's going to be this multi-million dollar. They have like these huge resort complexes all over the U.S., maybe more. But they're based in San Francisco. It's called Discovery Land Company. And through this gentleman, I got their email address. And so I gave that email address out on little cards with information who to talk. And I had all the executive officers listed because they had their names and pictures and email addresses on their website. And I also had the postcard from Spearhead Bay. There was actually a postcard. I had that postcard enlarged. And we started sending that postcard to Discovery Land Company. And we just inundated them with, just tormented them with all kinds of different. I told people, just, you know, whatever you want to do. If you want to send them a letter, that'd be really good. Calls are best. Letters are number two. Emails are three, because if you send a letter, the company knows there's like a lot of people upset. You know, and calls first, letter, then the email.
And that ended up with them wanting to change the name?
No.
It's not that simple, is it?
No. What happened was the students started picketing. Mm-hmm. I talked to the representatives in Coeur d'Alene. And I mean, I'll be frank, I threatened them. I said that I have friends at the Spokesman Review that would be happy to come over and do an article while we picket. I said, do you really want 25 fresh-faced young kids with these signs? And at first they were like trying to pacify me and placate me. Well, you know, we understand this is a problem because we had a resort, you know, down in whatever, and we just think it's a really resorty sound. And I go, well, okay, I'm not gonna be able to change your opinion, but I just want you to know, I don't want you to come out when you guys open and say, I'm shocked that there's a problem with this name, because I'm going to tell the press that you knew there's a problem and you did it anyway. And I said, I have no problem dressing up in full regalia and chaining myself to the sign. So, which myself, I'm sure I didn't do a bit to help the cause, but these kids, I'm sure, were the main reason that they ended up changing the name.
It was 2005 when Heather started giving speeches on the subject. In 2006, the big push started, recruiting signatures at Washington State University, calling the Gauzer Ranch owners, and picketing. While the push was on, she still had to go to work.
I was actually working at the Coeur d'Alene Tribes Museum in Cataldo, and this girl came in, this is in July, all dressed in this little snazzy outfit, and she had like a little name badge that said Gauzer Bay. Now, I knew they called it Gauzer Ranch, and so I asked her, what are you doing? She goes, oh, I've got a tour group that I'm bringing from Gauzer Ranch. And I go, well, whatever happened with that bay thing? She goes, oh, we changed that. We decided to name our bay Gauzer Bay, just to, because there were some problems. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And that's how I found out they changed it.
Success in 2006 on one place name. Perhaps 92 more to go in Idaho?
What's happening with the whole state of Idaho, I don't know.
We don't, yeah. Do you feel any sense of relief that the one thing has been changed, though?
Yes, because I don't have to drive by that sign anymore. I mean, I'm living in Palouse now and going to school here in Moscow, but I still go regularly to my cabin in Cataldo. And it just, yeah, it's one thing that's been taken off the chalkboard, but there's 92 other if they're still out there. Now I'm all bummed out. Now I got to figure out what's going on here with the 92.
I'll find out too and let you know.
Heather and I had this conversation on October 17th, 2008. She wasn't sure at the time of the final outcome of the entire state's place name issue. Not even 3 weeks after our talk, on November 4th, 2008, an email was circulated by Frank Roberts. He's the Coeur d'Alene Tribe's Geographic Information Systems Manager. I'll read it to you. I know I've been providing these updates about every 6 months, but this should be the last one. It's official. All 15 of the offensive names for geographic features, that is, mountains and streams, in the tribe's territory have officially been changed. The last two names were changed this month by the U.S. Board of Geographic Names, Siestem and Tiqua Creeks. The mission is finally done. It's hard to believe it took from February of 2006 till now to happen. I would like to thank Felix Arepa and Raymond Brinkman for their work on this project. It has been a pleasure to help in the rewrite of history. These 15 names that Frank reported on are a great triumph. The S-Word Project in Idaho is a related but still incomplete project.
That was from Heather Kay with music by Eulalie. This last installment is a performance piece. It's slam poetry by author Susan Power. It's my favorite for many reasons, not least of which is the power with which Susan Power delivers her rant, as she calls it.
In school, I am shy, bookish, polite. I sit on my hands until the Indian in me erupts from her wooden post in the back of the room. Sometimes it's just too much, and I wave my hand in the air and hear myself speak with a vigor so unexpected it turns every head. They're praising Custer again and his Shirley Temple-like curls of gold. It's the gold we should talk about now, his metal fever. They say we crossed the Bering Strait in a chilly migration from Russian lands, when all of us know we grew from this ground like corn, or fell from the sky like ripe seeds in the pocket of our mother's dress. They tell me our women were oppressed, worked like mules by lazy men, and they don't want to hear my grandma's name or write it down. Josephine Gates Kelly, born 1888, tribal chairperson, head of the Standing Rock Sioux in the 1950s, when other American women are trapped in the kitchen baking pies, martini perfumed, with those red, red mouths and cone-sharp breasts, chewing tranquilizers like mints to keep them still, help them like Ike. They fall into the laudanum bed of their day. Oh, it's Hopi, not Hoppy, I gently say. But I do not mention that as far as I know, there is no tribe of giant rabbits in this land. And every November, the gobbler art, turkeys and pilgrims and pumpkins and Indians too, naked beneath their one stiff feather, cut from construction paper, unzipping the Thanksgiving myth that we ever broke even bread. My religious teacher, Mrs. Burns, says Puritans suffered the grim voyage from England to the black scars of Plymouth Rock because of persecution. And I know the intolerable weight of condemnation, where a ruling order declares that your God is not God, and your prayers are worse than futile. They are the sweet stink of burnt flowers, the devil's foolishness. Yet she will not acknowledge my hand, Mrs. Burns, when it peeps in the air, wilting, ignored. She already knows the questions I'll raise, why the sins of the fatherland are played out in the old new world by folks who should have known better. Thank God for my mother's Sacajawea-like sense of direction. She points north. This gathering of storm clouds woman, her needle forever set magnetically on activism. Trouble. People rise up and chase the money changers from the temple, dash their scales upon the stone floors. She helps me carve a space for myself and my voice in every white world I encounter from year to year and grade to grade. This is how my head is padded, my face held in a brief gesture of hopefulness by Martin Luther King when I am 3. This is how I find myself reading my middle school poems at age 11 and 12 with a lineup of literary angels like Tumbleweed, our Black Creek friend with her pom-pom braids, and Dennis Brutus, just released from prison in South Africa, bearing his colored card, his BIA-like determination of how much blood makes you more than white in Johannesburg. Okay, that was part one, and I missed part of it, so now we're on to part two, but I need some water. Okay. And this is true. For the past 12 years or so, I've had a recurring dream about my country. I see our great cities underwater, the Statue of Liberty tipped from her pedestal, not Planet of the Apes like buried in sand, but swallowed by the great ocean that washes her face with salt. Life is spent on long boats shaped like canoes, longer even than the imagination, and natives man the oars, not rowing slave-like to a beaten drum, but purpose-driven all the same, bent by compassion. We travel this world of water to save our burning are drowning. Relatives, black, white, we pluck them from the waves and sit them in the center of our boats where they huddle, stunned and chastened, ultimately grateful. I used to think this was a fiction of the mind, allegory, metaphor, or the less elegant labors of a brain churning the day's thoughts into a dull, confusing mush. But as the glaciers melt and superstorms, monstrouses, Grendel, smash our houses and our lives, I see us rushing towards the future of these boats. Listen to what Joy Harjo said in a book of poems. Oh, sun, moon, stars, our other relatives peering at us from the inside of God's house. Walk with us as we climb into the next century, naked but for the stories we have of each other. Keep us from giving up in this land of nightmares, which is also the land of miracles. We were saved by our stories, our crop that never dies through every drought and dust bowl, every Himmler-like policy of death, every cultural root canal suffered in a boarding school. Don't you know we are the people of tinnitus? We cannot sleep for all the ringing in our ears. The ghosts of our ancestors sing us songs to keep us awake, 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 noisier than television sirens. Their voices gather in a crescendo of wisdom that bursts through time, a sonic boom to spill you on your ass. We have no choice but to listen eventually. Remember who we were before the pain and the painkiller, the fire water and the diabetes, the bingo palaces and welfare programs, the Ivy League schools and powwow circuits, the American dream. The strongest stories are homegrown. They didn't travel from another world. They weren't filtered through a test tube microscope, Bible injection, calculus equation, symphony of black quarter notes trapped on the page. Our stories surround us, whether they're res or urban, whether our tribe was forcibly removed or stubbornly hid. In the hills, in the woods, in the swamps, they twist inside us, remarkable as DNA, insistent, generous, a lifeline thrown to each generation. What's more, they are true. No matter how inventive, preposterous, no matter how much so-called magical realism is involved. How do I know? Because they peeled me down to the core, sloughed off stories I'd learned in school. Crim law with Dershowitz, con law with Larry Tribe, Stendhal, and even Walker Percy, a kind of exfoliation of the intellect and spirit where I find myself saying what I mean and meaning what I say, where I forget how to double-talk bullshit, logic my way into a righteous corner justified by footnotes citing evidence. Our sovereign stories lead us to freedom. We make it through the looking glass world of all the upside-down, half-assed Indian policies that trot through history like a roll call of childhood diseases. The Allotment Act, the Indian Reorganization Act, termination, the Indian Wars that never really ended but just changed venue. We emerge from madness and arrogance, prejudice and ignorance, our stories intact, stronger for the test of fire, the forge. We share them in cars, at kitchen tables, poetry slams and art exhibitions, in our novels and chapbooks and cheap motels and classrooms and shake tents and medicine lodges, funeral parlors and bars. Soon you will hear us too, buzzing hotly like bees. We will haunt you with our tales, though we are not ghosts, we are not finished, exterminated, we are not conquered, we are not lost, we are not at the end of the trail or the end of our rope, we are not a problem, a fad, a guru, a channeling queen, a pet, or a mascot, a jumble of bones in a drawer. We are old stories groping forward into every new world. We made it here by the skin of our teeth. No one can stop us now from telling and telling and telling. It is our turn to run the schools and teach you the anthem, the pledge of allegiance to every other being on the planet. Pull down the pyramid with a human face on top. No, that's already happening without our intervention. Don't you see? We are already building the long boats with these words. Thank you.
And that's Susan Power with a very powerful rant. I think that's the only name she gives it, is rant. That's going to wrap up this show of Playing Favorites, where I played for you a number of my favorite pieces from the past 3 years of Yin Radio. I will leave you, though, with another favorite. This is the favorite artist, singer-songwriter that I've discovered in these past 3 years. The song is called Angels, and it's by Alison Krauss.
At least that's what I thought at the time, but my mouth was open and these words of repression. So maybe I overdo, but take who this is or let me be. Cause all the angels in the world couldn't hold a candle to me. And no one will ever love you like I do. My fire.
Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show. You can listen to past shows, podcast this show, or sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. Drop us a line if you'd like at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and you can hear Yin Radio around the country. For instance, on KYRS 92.3 and 89.9 FM. That's in Spokane, Washington. That's Thin Air Radio. I am Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.
Understand.